Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 83, section 6, which is old single column, page 927. Okay. So as we were noting at the end of the preceding session, we've reached the climax point of this paper, the first part of these three papers on marriage and family, where they're going to formally acknowledge that true monogamy is one of the indispensables to advancing civilization. And remember, it's in contrast to a very curious initially expression that they used in the preceding section, where they said true polygyny. And we were contemplating that. How can polygyny ever be described as true? Here we have that adjective again, true monogamy, we'll think about. Obviously, it must be used at least in the sense that it was being used with true polygyny. And the question is, is there more immediate recognition available in this case than there was there? Let's see. I think that's about all we have to say up front. Let's just jump in and unpack this. There's a lot of wonderful material here that closes out this paper. So let's just get to it.
Section 6, true monogamy, pair marriage. Monogamy is monopoly. It is good for those who attain this desirable state, but it tends to work a biologic hardship on those who are not so fortunate. But quite regardless of the effect on the individual, monogamy is decidedly best for the children.
Okay, so before we go to the bulk of that, I'll just point out that last statement about monogamy is decidedly best for the children. They come back around to explain that a little bit more at the end of the section. So we'll just table that discussion until then. So let's think about the rest of it. I mean, it's pretty straightforward, and they will expand on this, but this issue of trying to get to this goal, they call it a desirable state. Is a challenge against, as we've been reading, against the natural animal origin nature of mankind and the mores that we've set up that, we're more accepting of our natural state of affairs and didn't challenge us so significantly. But, as mankind moved forward, more and more ideals have had an impression upon our behavior, our recognition of ideals, and we've been striving towards this more and more. So, you're then face to face with what they're saying, but it tends to work a biologic hardship on those who are not so fortunate. Biologic hardship because there's no turning off our biologic urges. They are what they are, and there are no off switches. Obviously, there's a negative side effect of, if you don't have sort of a more established outlet for these biologic urges, you're likely to have a lot more societal issues of various sorts because of that. detrimental societal issues. But anyway, you know, as they sum up in the first part of that final sentence, see, but, right? So, I mean, it's such a significant fact, right? It's going to be one of the indispensables of advancing civilization. It's such a significant fact that, you know, they can say but, quite regardless of the effect on the individual. And so, you know, that's a harsh challenge, that the way the universe sees it, the fact that individuals are going to struggle in this regard is just part of the process. The universe is kind of harsh on the individual, right? The most, you know, the way the Most Highs rule in the kingdoms of men. I mean, they give no consideration to the individual. And if they're going to make, you know, things transpire so it's the greatest good for the greatest number of people for the greatest length of time, that inescapably means it's not going to go very well for a small number of people for a short period of time. It's just, you know, when so much of what we're about is not individual meaning, you know, so much of our lives exists to establish the meaning in the supreme, right? The whole, not the parts. You know, it's just inescapable that it'll seem at this early stage that the universe could just care less about us as individuals. We can spend our whole lives working very earnestly to, you know, establish some order and beauty in some little nook of the world on a, you know, a massive earthquake or hurricane or tornado or something just obliterates it, and it's as if we never did anything our entire life. You know, the universe could just care less about all that arranging of molecules you did. You know, and it's not just the arranging of molecules, you know, externally. It's, you know, all the work you might be doing within. You know, you scrape and struggle and manage to get yourself educated, and then a tree falls on you the day after your graduation. You know, and the universe doesn't stop the tree. You know, so these rugged truths are, you know, are ever present. So that's one of the things that they're not just going to talk about the ideal of monogamy, but the obvious corollary that they're introducing right in the first paragraph of how difficult this can be for the individual, at least some individuals. Okay, let's keep going.
The earliest monogamy was due to force of circumstances, poverty. Monogamy is cultural and societal, artificial and unnatural. That is, unnatural to evolutionary man. It was wholly natural to the pure Noddites and Adamites, and has been of great cultural value to all advanced races.
Okay, now there's some interesting little tidbits. You notice these little paragraphs because they're giving us kind of juicy tidbits to begin with. Right, I mean, obviously, you know, as we, from what we were seeing before, you know, the earliest monogamy, you know, was due to force of circumstances, poverty. But, you know, notice how in that next sentence, they just state it directly like I do all the time, right? You know, to get to, you know, in this case, we're talking about monogamy. To get to monogamy, especially true monogamy, that's wholly unnatural, foundationally. Notice that's the second word. So first and foremost, it's just, you know, plain unnatural for that to exist. And then on top of that, you know, the word that they add to that foundation of unnatural, artificial. It's an art form, right? You start with, okay, first of all, I just have to challenge myself to not go with what's natural, okay? So I've kind of set naturalness aside. Now what? Well, now in that space, I have to artistically, wisely, insightfully build this phenomenon. So see, it's very much you know, a sort of a pure human construct. But then they point out that is for evolutionary man. Right? When you're purely up from the humus. But notice that fascinating thing, that if you take higher genetics and you attune mind to that higher genetics, monogamy is natural in that mind. Right? That there doesn't, it's not a nurture issue at all, if you will. It's a nature issue. And that's just kind of an interesting thing to think about. I could rearrange, you know, the molecules in my chromosomes to the point where suddenly I would just be completely naturally monogamous. Isn't that a fascinating statement?
I like to look at it like, you know, the civilization is still right here and it's still kind of a flat, even the top level is kind of a flat. And it hasn't come up to the crest here, you know, where it comes together again.
I mean, just, you know, that, I mean, obviously the whole civilizational construct reflects the character of the individuals involved, you know, the citizens of the states involved in that civilization. We see these contrasting things. You know, what things are purely nurture and what things are purely nature? And you know, we saw the jealousy. You know, there's nothing natural about that at all. That's purely a learned phenomenon, you know, the way we're unfortunately nurtured by our environment. But here we see, and we've talked about this many times, that we can't even imagine what things will be completely natural when you have the kind of biology that the mortals do in a world enlightened life. You know, it's not just monogamy, but so many things. I mean, so much of a well-formed, significant personal living philosophy in the upper domain of everyone's mind. It's just there. When you attune that mind to that genetics that we can't even imagine, it's so advanced relative to ours. You know, so. Just, you know, the point is just to remind yourself again of how much the way your mind functions is just an automatic result of its attunement to your genetics, and that a lot of the way that you get a much more advanced culture on a world is not because there's a better education system or something, right? It's just the genetics is just so much better. They start on the correct page so automatically in so many ways. That whole bit I emphasize all the time, in our wildest imagination, we can't imagine a normal world in a post-Bestowal Sun Age. You know, forget about light and life. You know, just remind yourself of why that is. Why can't you imagine that? Because your genetics won't allow it. Your genetics limits your imagination. You know, it doesn't matter how much you think you have absolute free will and you could imagine anything. No, you can't. You really are very limited in your imaginative ability. You know, and so it's, yeah, that's just kind of a fascinating thing to think about. All right, let's keep going.
So, Chris.
Oh, yep.
So, is that true for all worlds that genetics has to be?
Mm-hmm. Every world, right, has to. Like I've pointed out many times, even with a full biologic uplift, you know, that doesn't get any world to light and life. Only the genetic engineering that happens on every world gets them to light and life. Okay. Because, no matter how much biologic uplifting occurs, it's still biologic uplifting. You aren't just taking people from Gerasim and making them the inhabitants of a world, right? That genetics is when the children of the Adam and Eve on that world engage the evolutionary stock, the genetics is pulled down. I mean, yeah. It's uplifted, But the Adamic quality is pulled down, right? So, you know, the goal is the genetics, you know, it's like Adam and Eve. And so, you know, you can't get that sort of naturally. You know, it's an art form to engineer that going forward on every world.
Okay. Oh, yeah. When you talk about imagination, is there an ability to grow the capacity of that imagination in a good way? You said we don't have any idea.
Again, we just have to be patient. I mean, you know, your imagination will grow as you move up the imagined worlds. You know, in this life, we're just stuck with our genetics. You know? There's just nothing we can. In this life, perforce you serve two masters, and you know, advanced genetic engineering is not around the corner. It's not going to happen in my lifetime, you know, or your lifetime, or anyone in this room. You know,
just being aware of the fact that we are stuck.
Yeah, that's the important thing. You've got it. You know that, so that you don't. Humility is easier, right? You don't have such a tendency to think, oh well, I can. You know, there isn't any possibility that I haven't considered. I mean, I am so objective and so imaginative. You know, I've thought it all out in advance. You know, no, it's just, you know, we have to be humble and limit, you know, recognize how limited we are, you know, and that's one of the serious problems we face today is everyone wanting to existentialize everything they think, you know, and absolutize everything they think. You know, well, boy, this thought is of eternity and absoluteness, seriously, you know. And so we really need some humility. Pride is consuming us here, and that's the pride that, you know, that leads to a fall is why the book is here, right? We the civilization could fall, could collapse. Okay, lots of questions.
The technique for genetically engineering on each different world, is the technique different?
Yeah, sure. I mean, every world is different, yeah. Right. Yeah, so the technique is going to be different in every world. Again, that's why I stressed it's artificial. It's an art form. You know, on every world.
And that technique has to be figured out each different.
You know, even the designing of life for each world is an art form, you know, and tailored to each world.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think two things. That's why the tragedy of, I think you brought it up when you read that paper, of Abel. I mean, being just killed, you know, at an early age.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you lose that genetic potential because when he's younger, it's not that obvious. Because, you know,
genetics takes time to unfold.
If he had lived to be 25 or 30,
right.
He would have, you know. And the second thing, too, whenever you mention genetic engineering, I think of this micromanagement. You know, we're going to put this gene here and put this gene. I don't know, reading paper 77 and just in general, it's like I don't know how to put it, but it's a wholesale transition to that level, to that Adamic level.
A good example of how this works, you know, notice it doesn't just mention Adamites in that sentence. It says Nodites and Adamites.
Right.
Okay. And, you know, the Nodites got to be included in that sentence over a 300,000-year time. Right, I mean, they weren't immediately of Adamic quality genetics, you know. Like they point out in paper 77, you know, it was a slow mutagenic process over those 300,000 years before before the rebellion.
Interesting that you read it. I didn't read it.
That their genetics morphs over time. I mean, you know, rather than it being just all at once, because again. See, I mean, the way you, the thing that leads you immediately to be looking for that is, it's a physical system, and physical systems have inertia. So you can't just turn them on a dime. In, you know, with, you know, the exception of of those phase changes that are the suddenlies in biologic evolution. But in general, you know, the process of, see, you're not changing the species. You know, they're staying the humans that, you know, that were built, right? So you know, you don't have that kind of a speciesation sort of suddenly. You have a gradual mutagenic process that it morphs over time, and you know it would have continued to morph, you know, if there hadn't been a rebellion. You know, so that the genetics that would have given rise to those material offspring of the prince's staff that were supposed to mate with the first generation Adamites, you know, that would have been an even more significant combination. But undoubtedly, it got a long ways in 300,000 years, and that's basically validated right here. The fact that they just include them in this, that it was wholly natural,
yeah,
you know, for them. So
one other thing.
Oh, okay, yep.
It's interesting, though. Yeah, like you say, it was the children of Adam and Eve that were life carriers, suggested to mate with the first generation Nodites.
No, the first generation Adamites were going to mate with these material offspring of the prince's staff.
Right.
This first generation, you know, we've talked about that when we read Adam and Eve. The first generation Adamites, see, were designed to be different. They were only sort of half downstepped. You get the impression, see, that they probably weren't supposed to mate with the evolutionary stock. The second generation and beyond were supposed to mate. That those first generation were supposed to just be mating with the offspring of the prince's staff.
Most of the Adamic uplift that we got was not even from the first generation, it was Adam himself.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and I remember you bringing that out.
Right.
That's why they say it was a limited but potent upliftment.
Right.
Potent.
Yeah, but again, you know, we when we read that, you know, when they did all that artificial insemination of those women, you know, directly from Adam, you know, we noted obviously there was some genetic engineering involved in that. It wasn't, you know, just a straightforward thing, because otherwise all those women would have died in childbirth, and they obviously didn't. All right, so they did, you know, they were doing some genetic engineering and downstepping that a little bit, you know, so that, you know, it wasn't a death sentence for all those women. But anyway, yeah, it just reminds you, you know, the way we can get off on a genetics tangent like that. It really doesn't matter what you're talking about with society, culture, civilization. It always has this genetic foundation aspect to it. You know, like they tell you, so you'd love to come up with some scheme to eliminate human inequality. Well, we need to tell you that fundamentally, that's a genetic issue. See, and only genetic engineering is going to deal with that. You know, so they often bring in those stark statements, you know, about, you know, how we have to face the facts of genetics. We can't let our ideals imagine that there aren't significant limitations to all of us, and some of us even more so, genetically. Okay, let's keep going here.
Is that Chaldean or Chaldean?
Chaldean.
The Chaldean tribes recognized the right of a wife to impose a premarital pledge upon her spouse not to take a second wife or concubine. Both the Greeks and the Romans favored monogamous marriage. Ancestor worship has always fostered monogamy, as has the Christian error of regarding marriage as a sacrament. Even the elevation of the standard of living has consistently militated against plural wives. By the time of Michael's advent on Urantia, practically all of the civilized world had attained the level of theoretical monogamy. But this passive monogamy did not mean that mankind had become habituated to the practice of real pair marriage.
Okay, bunch of things there. So first of all, just starting out, where the preceding paragraph left off, why did you have this with the Chaldean tribes? In other words, those tribes down in southern Mesopotamia, because of course that's coming from the Nadites that were down there way, way back when. The Chaldeans are the tail end of that Nadite phenomenon there between the rivers. So even when it's not straightforwardly natural thing, right? It's very much a strong element of their mores system coming down from the Nadites. And of course, the same way with the Greeks and then over into the Romans because of the Andites, the same thing. No matter how much it's diluted and down the road, and hence not straightforwardly natural, it's nonetheless strongly cultural because of the Andite heritage there. Then you start to have these issues that in some ways are problematic, but coincidentally it does end up fostering monogamy. Like the more you fixate on ancestor worship, the more you would have a hard time having a sense of purity about your ancestor worship because it's all diffused into this menagerie phenomenon, right? As they straightforwardly say, the Christian error, treating it as a sacrament, marriage as a sacrament. Notice that they directly say error. To point out, even though you are, you're bringing in this false concept that a spirit and eternity and whatnot is in play, and that this is God's act or whatever, no matter how, it depends on how strongly you think of it as in this mode. But, they're not saying evil, okay? Just error, right? Because it's just a figment. You're combining goodness with figment. Right? It's a figment of your imagination that it's a sacrament. Right? So it's just merely an error. It's not the kind of error that, inescapably results from evil being in play first. They would, if they wanted you to think of it more harshly, they would have said, as has the Christian mistake of regarding marriage as a sacrament. Right? See, that mis prefix means wrong, means that it's evil. So it's not just merely error, it's evil and error. Okay.
How are they using the definition of sacrament
there? That idea that there's something very sacred. I mean, they'll explain it a little bit more in a minute here. That God is involved, or the deity is involved. That this isn't just a human affair, right? This is a heavenly affair. And of course, even Jesus tried to, temper that, but Christianity went right ahead and, no, I think we're being married in heaven. We're not just being married on earth. This is eternal, and putting an inappropriate burden upon the whole phenomenon. Right? I mean, you should take it seriously, but, let's not get carried away here. Don't heap all of infinity and eternity on your shoulders here as you try to struggle to have a relationship with the opposite sex. Obviously the standard of living, it just gets way too expensive. That whole polygyny thing we were talking about last time. And then, and then at the end there, like I was saying, I mean, you finally, not just because you have such an immediate relationship to Noddite or Andite history, but just the slow advance of cultural evolution, the leading edge of the world, is definitely has theoretical monogamy out, and it's holding out in front. Everyone has kind of gotten to that point. But then the key thing they throw in, see, and then they say, but this passive monogamy, and your first thought is like, passive? But you keep reading. This passive monogamy did not mean that mankind had become habituated to the practice of real paramarriage. And the thing that strikes you there is like, real. They threw in the modifier real. And you go, well, now wait a minute. Chris often talks about, I should notice when they say real. And a lot of times he says that means you've brought eternity into play. Well, didn't we just say that eternity, we were overplaying it to think that this was all about eternity instead of about time? Well, you can't be simplistic. Sometimes when you say real, you're just trying to point out that it's not merely an actuality, it's a reality, that there's pattern, that there's purposing, that there's personality in play. Little asterisk, footnote, your personality has a linkage to eternity, but it's not the eternity thing that's immediately, what they're trying to point out. It's the fact that personalities that can choose are in play. So it's not just an fancy animal actuality, it's a human reality. And see, when you think about a personality, a personalized self, persons act. Right? Your mind just in and of itself functions, but the personality adds an additional element to mere functioning of your mind. Personalities and persons can act. They're active. Oh, yeah, that's why they said passive. See, it's in contrast to active. And so then it starts to make sense why they said it that way and why they said real. That's the active, all right? So taking it beyond just the concept, but actually acting, using your free will to do that unnatural thing that they talked about just above, right? You can't just go with the natural functioning of your mind. You set the stage with your personality, your action, in setting natural aside, and then you use the character that's there because you're a person to have the art, the artistry to do that artificial thing they were talking about. So there's a simple little example again where noticing these curious words and not just blowing through, and maybe even trying out, I think real means this. It's like, well, no, that doesn't seem to make sense. That seems to contradict. The book can't be interpreted simplistically. I keep saying this almost every week, because we just keep coming upon it. You have to think very methodically and insightfully all the time to properly interpret. The word real is a word that's used in a number of modes.
At minimum, I think that you've got to be able to distinguish the baseline, like Jesus talked about, the stereoscopic vision, the volitional and the mathematical. And if you're not doing that, and there's lots of people in the Urantia movement not, and you're deferring to the least of us among us, well, we have to be like them. No. No. Because they're not seeing, obviously. They come in with these think equality and heavenly is right now. Right now. And they'll argue with you.
Right. Yeah, again, I mean, just, yeah, and, you know, to remember, I point out all the time, you know, one of the important things to recognize up front is this isn't a dispensational revelation. So it isn't meant for universality. And just that would help to not slip into this unfortunate cultural mode, like you're saying, of trying to, of lowering yourself and your relationship to the revelation down to some supposed equality, which is just that lowest common denominator sort of a state, right? I mean, the book is genuinely trying to find the few on the planet, percentage terms, the few that are ready to challenge the natural state, and certainly, those that haven't bought into these false exaltations of the natural, like you're saying, it's like, well, we need to all be like, the run-of-the-mill person naturally is, because that's divine. It's like, no.
That's how divine the average person. Yeah,
no, we need to challenge ourselves to be unnatural. I mean, a great example of falling into the natural trap is embodied in, I want to be spiritual, not religious. Because you're naturally spiritual. Religion is innately an unnatural state of mind. That's the difference. Spiritual is natural. Religious is unnatural. Right? Spiritual experience is natural. Personal spiritual experience, religious experience, is unnatural because it's personal. Right? You aren't using your personality at all until there's an unnatural state in your mind. Right? So that's a very key thing. Like I said, you get up there in the religion papers, and then that bullet point list of a religionist, responds like this to this stimulus, like this to this stimulus, etc. And then it sums it up in the end. It says these unnatural responses make you a religionist. Right? They aren't the natural spiritual responses, merely spiritual responses to stimuli. They're the unnatural religious responses. And so it's just that fact that you're trying to lift yourself up far from that lowest common natural denominator. Far, far. That's the challenge. On the one hand, it might be sad that it isn't there amongst readers of the book, as you said. But remember, it's just a general problem. In 16:6, it doesn't say it's sad to record that your Urantia book readers, don't take delight in cultivating. It's just right. I mean, we have a general problem. Whether what book you're reading is incidental, all right, when fundamentally you don't have your insight eyes open. That's the deeper problem. Okay.
So the Chaldeans seem to recognize the wife's original prenup.
Oh, yeah, yeah, and again, well, yeah, yeah, we could bring out that little point. Notice the recognition of the basic dynamics. That it's like they pointed out, yeah, you can say polygamy, okay, but mostly it was polygyny. Very seldom was it polyandry, right? The basic dynamic here, comes from our animal origin. In a pack of chimpanzees, you don't have one female and many males. Right, you have one male and many females. That's our animal origin nature. They're recognizing that. So you put that in the hands of the wife, right? Now remember, your challenge is to not be so natural, son. Right?
Not really that new, the prenup.
Yeah. Because I think the basic phenomenon is the same as it's always been. Yeah. Mating is mating. All right, let's keep going.
While pursuing the monogamic goal of the ideal pair marriage, which is, after all, something of a monopolistic sex association, society must not overlook the unenviable situation of those unfortunate men and women who fail to find a place in this new and improved social order, even when having done their best to cooperate with and enter into its requirements. Failure to gain mates in the social arena of competition may be due to insurmountable difficulties or multitudinous restrictions which the current mores have imposed. Truly, monogamy is ideal for those who are in, but it must inevitably work great hardships on those who are left out in the cold of solitary existence.
Oh, that ends harsh, doesn't it? Yes, could you use a more chilling metaphor? Yes.
Definitely a December paper.
December paper to remember, yeah. So we had a big paragraph break. And, you know, we basically have kind of stated the issue about monogamy. But, see, they don't want to go very far without coming back to why there needs to be wisdom and not just zeal for purity. If you're going to have a functioning society, the more you push it like this towards ideals, they're challenging you between the lines there. You need to think non-simplistically. You may need to have some complexity in this system where those that can't quite meet this monogamy ideal, for like you're saying, for a lot of times reasons maybe that are kind of beyond their control even, do you just say, well, tough nuggies? Do you just, are you that devoid of compassion and sympathy? Well, then you aren't a very advanced human. You know, your purity towards this one ideal doesn't make you divine. So maybe there needs to be some allowance for some other modalities and, to find their place. They may not be, society doesn't have to hold them up as what everyone should be striving for, but it also doesn't have to demonize them. It doesn't have to round these people up and throw them in jail. Where they basically are is polygamy.
In an odd way, though, that's not really the problem
today. Yeah.
The problem is taking these other less than ideal and idealizing them and demanding that society recognize the equality of all relationships.
Right. Yeah. And so, right, you see, that's, that false spiritualization of things, where everything is, supposed to be held as equal. You'll see them re-emphasizing this here shortly. We're talking about this foundational element of civilization, which is not merely pair relationship. No, it's male-female pairing for the purpose of procreation that produces a family. That's the foundation of civilization. It's not that those other things are bad. Or anything, remember that. We're just focusing on this foundational element of civilization because that's the whole point of the book in my lap. There's a civilizational emergency. There's not a relationship emergency. There's a civilizational emergency. There's not an individual emergency. That's kind of the relationship emergency, right? There's not even a spiritual emergency in individuals. Right? It's this collective civilizational emergency. So that's what they're focusing on and trying to get us to recognize. And, you know, but then they throw in these things. Okay, well, now don't forget. Okay, you can. All good things taken to extreme become bad. If you hyper-focus on that alone, you know, and totally ignore the negative consequences for those who can't achieve this nucleation, you know, mode, civilization isn't just built with nuclei, you know, if you will. There's other, you know, there's a greater complexity. So now just remind you between the lines, and this, you'll see this comes up again, you know, that you know, it's a difficult thing. You know, you can't be allowing of sort of everything. It can't be an anything goes morality, if you will, right, or mores system. But, right, they're just reminding you, the more you push a non-Adamic people towards this ideal, you know, there's a lot that are not going to achieve this great end, and you need to take care of them. There has to be kindness, you know, at least. There has to be brotherly love, consideration, like they're saying, of your less fortunate brothers and sisters in this process. And, you know, how are you going to work that? Yeah. So, I mean, we don't need to try to get into the science of that right now, but, you know, just pointing out that, see, philosophically, they're reminding you of that complexity. Okay, let's see.
At least allow them a reasonable opportunity for self-realization.
Yeah, some sort of mode. Give people a mode. You know, or if you want to say even more minimalistically, at least don't, you know, set up a society where if you find someone who's single, you know, you haul them out in the town square and ridicule them.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, we certainly we can at least not do that, right? Demonize those that haven't met our great pure ideal. Yeah, but like I'm saying, I mean, that's very low-hanging fruit, you know. But it's still happening a lot. The more complicated thing is, how can you set up some sort of equity, right? There is an equality. You're not going to achieve some simplistic equality, so there's this automatic purity. You've got a diversity, and you have to have a system that is harmonious with an equity of different, that allows some diversity of modes. All right. Let's see. Did we get everything else there? I think we did. Keep going.
Always have the unfortunate few had to suffer that the majority might advance under the developing mores of evolving civilization. But always should the favored majority look with kindness and consideration on their less fortunate fellows, who must pay the price of failure to attain membership in the ranks of those ideal sex partnerships which afford the satisfaction of all biologic urges under the sanction of the highest mores of advancing social evolution.
Okay, so there's, you know, we already kind of fleshed this out. And you notice, see, they brought up kindness, right? Because obviously that's the immediate thing that's in play, is that fourth level of meaning, you know, so-called brotherly love, right? That level of kindness. Kin likeness, they're your brothers and sisters, don't forget that. And we always have this tendency when we get some, you know, sort of definitive notion in our heads that we have a tendency to ismize. We tend to immediately form dichotomies, right? You know, we're with our political parties, you know, your political party. You know, everyone is your brother and sister, but not the people in that other party. They're not my brothers and sisters. I mean, they're demonic. It's so easy to lose kindness. See, to drop down and have it just be a lower domain of the hourglass phenomenon, to not even have that foundation of the fourth level of humanity to it. So, you know, just, you know, and that, you know, consideration, you know, so that you're, you have that degree of objectivity, and from that predicate, you consider what's going on and try to find a way to soften the blows of the vicissitudes of life. You know,
you know, well, just even like when we were younger, when I was younger, I mean, this don't ask, don't tell for homosexuals, you know, I mean, it's just, but now it's like Gene was talking about, it's gotten into a militant.
Yeah, we.
And, I wonder if how much of that was from, you know, every once in a while you hear a killing of a person who's homosexual or something. Like that.
Well, again, remember in general, I bring this up all the time. I just said it basically a minute ago. I mean, whenever you, when humans focus on something definitively, because we're so much more spiritual now in general, it's just inescapable that you ismize this, and. And hence you demand this equality, you know, of that element relative to every other element. I mean, you know, you just think in these, you know, they're going to mention this, you know, that this is the problem that, you know, as we challenge ourselves to monogamy, we overplay this and it becomes hyper-ismized and ends up being, you know, instead of getting the net result of more monogamous relationships, you actually get less lasting relationships because you overplay this. And like I said, we always do this now. We always overplay things, and if it doesn't mess it up for you merely, you know, it's going to, you know, it at least does that, you know, but most likely it's going to cause a social problem, like you're just saying. You know, you become this inappropriate hammer on your fellow man. I'm going to pound my ism, you know, on you, and you're going to submit to my ism. It's like, well, we all can't be everything. You know, it doesn't work that way. You know, it all can't be me-ism. Because if everyone goes into full-on me-ism, you end up with one person on the planet eventually. And that's the only way to achieve that ideal. Is to kill everyone else. You know, it drives us to civil war when we overplay this spiritualization of something, thinking of it like you know the sacrament, the sacred thing. See, that's that same sort of ismizing of it, falsely spiritualizing it. All right. Okay. But anyway, just. The cold of solitary existence wasn't enough. They had to devote a whole paragraph. We all know very well this is difficult. Yeah, and like I said, they're now about to talk about kind of why it's gotten so so extensive that this difficulty is in play. Let's keep reading here.
Monogamy always has been, now is, and forever will be the idealistic goal of human sex evolution. This ideal of true pair marriage entails self-denial, and therefore does it so often fail, just because one or both of the contracting parties are deficient in that acme of all human virtues, rugged self-control.
Okay, so... They wanted to devote a whole paragraph to that punchline. We've seen this over and over again. That's the big challenge. Like all the problems that resulted from the Lucifer Rebellion, that inability to distinguish between true and false liberty. Well, what's the fundamental difference? You know, what makes false liberty false? Lack of recognition of personal responsibility and the subsequent exercise of self-control. Right? Is where its falsehood comes from. That false liberty they're talking about. See, the acme, right? The peak of all human virtues, rugged self-control. facing the rugged truths, not turning away, facing them head on and taking a hold of yourself, and demanding that you be like the cosmos. Right. Self-control, rugged self-control culminates in self-mastery. Right. In the same way that you have the ultimate in the master universe, that master universe, see, self-mastery, right? That's the end point you're striving for. But it begins with self-control, self-control, more and more self-control. And to make that transition, not merely the negative of self-denial, right? Go beyond the history of self-denial, right? Switch it into the positive mode, just like Jesus switched the golden rule into the positive mode. Switch it into the positive mode of self-control, right? Because eventually you come up against the fact that in this life, for force, you serve two masters, right? And it's delusional to think that you can just pretend that other master doesn't exist and you can just deny it, see? For instance, fear is not going to somehow disappear, but it can become mastered and become focus. Same energy, different emotional response. Right? Because, see, the natural, when we say fear, what you always think of is your emotional response. You aren't thinking the physics of it, that there's a particular energy form in your mind that naturally produces that emotional response. Right? You're not going to make that energy form disappear. But you can have an unnatural emotional response, if you will. See? You can eventually have an unnatural response to that. When that form appears in your mind, instead of it, kind of taking over and you come apart, in panic, terror, it becomes this point in your mind that allows you to focus very definitively. It's this very energetic little nugget that used to be scary to you. But you're not afraid of such poignant energy anymore. You take a hold of it and wield it. Use it as a focus point in your mind. That's a mastered self. All those things, that's what you're trying to do. You're trying not to pretend they aren't there or somehow magically transcend them. You're going to take control of them and use them. You're going to purpose them to better ends. Then the other little thing that leads into the next paragraph, notice the ideal of true pair marriage. Right? So they brought that true in. And let's read the next paragraph and kind of really talk about this whole true monogamy thing now, finally.
Monogamy is the yardstick which measures the advance of social evolution.
Social.
Civilization, as distinguished from purely biologic evolution. Monogamy is not necessarily biologic or natural, but it is indispensable to the immediate maintenance and further development of social civilization. It contributes to a delicacy of sentiment, a refinement of moral character, and a spiritual growth which are utterly impossible in polygamy. A woman never can become an ideal mother when she is all the while compelled to engage in rivalry for her husband's affections.
Okay, why don't we deal with the last little element there before we get to the indispensable and such. Just that very strong statement. It contributes to a delicacy of sentiment, a refinement of moral character, and a spiritual growth. So the kind of the full spectrum there, see, which are utterly impossible in polygamy. Very strong statement. So again, it reminds you why this is the goal of all civilizational evolution, why it's natural in Adamites. Okay. It's just a natural part of a mind that's functioning in its at the higher potentials of creature mind. And then they give you that just that one little element. Again, reminding you that the polygamy they're talking about is mostly polygyny. When you have multiple women, again, it doesn't matter how much she challenges herself, one of those women, she perforce serves two masters. She has some natural instincts that she can't turn off, and they'll get in the way of being an ideal mother, right? Like they're saying, if she has to engage in rivalry for her husband's affections, it's like, well, she can just not have any interest in her husband's affections. Yeah, like somehow you can just turn that off. You know, that's not gonna disappear magically because you find some switch somewhere. They're reminding you that there's pragmatic issues here. They just have to be faced. You have to face the facts and adjust them to ideals in order to have a wise system. Okay, so there's that aspect of it. Now, like I said, let's think about the indispensable. This one reminds you that it's not like the word indispensable only occurs 8 times in the book. Okay, it occurs in a lot of different modes. But there's only 8 times when it specifically is referring to the progress of civilization. Okay, and sometimes when it does it, it refers to other things. Like here, it's indispensable to the immediate maintenance. Okay, so there's 2 indispensables here that they're pointing to. But the ones I'm always holding up is the ones that are just about, they aren't about maintenance or things like that, but just the ones that are about the progress of civilization. And here you can very directly see this isn't one of the ones that's indispensable to the progress of early civilization. This is one, the progress of advancing civilization, the advancing of civilization. See, because you can see it right there. Monogamy is the yardstick which measures the advance of social civilization. They just spell it right out. You don't have to sort of get it between the lines. And the fact that the monogamy we're talking about here is true monogamy, not just sort of mere monogamy. It's true monogamy that's indispensable. Well, it's in the title, for one thing, of the section. So that's obviously the bottom line. But like I said, these 2 paragraphs go together. The ideal of true pair marriage, they had pair marriage in the title too. Right? Yeah, we're talking about true monogamy as one of the indispensables to advancing civilization. See, and it explicitly says civilization. It doesn't say society or merely culture, right? But civilization. So, like I said, if you look for those 8, you have to be very precisely focused, right? Not other kinds of indispensable, but just that specific issue relative to civilization, the fullness of civilization. It doesn't matter, if they qualify with social civilization or whatnot, like to do here, just, civilization. And you also see that we've brought it fully to a head. Like I said, in the first paper of these 3, we talked an awful lot about the biologic evolution, kind of natural sort of stuff, kind of the folkways and primitive mores that developed just kind of very naturally. But, you know, true monogamy is in stark contrast to what happens just totally naturally like that, like they're saying there. Right? It measures the advance of social civilization as distinguished from purely biologic evolution. So again, you have the four indispensable slavery, war, social classes, profit motive to the progress of early civilization, which is an awful lot about purely biologic evolution. Okay, and then the four subsequent ones, culminating in as far removed from biologic, you know, mere biologic attunement as you can challenge yourself to imagine. The term that they say, they didn't want to get too arbitrary in coining a term, so they used something that's quasi-approachable, God consciousness. But if you look closely throughout the book, they clarify that, don't think that that means God knowingness. God knowingness is what you have on when you get up to the sixth level of meaning. And God consciousness is something after you ascend many levels of cosmic wisdom up from that starting point, you achieve this most transcendent end, you know, which you have to directly leverage off of your adjuster and all kinds of things to get all the way up to that very rarefied fact that they decided to call God consciousness, and hope that you didn't get confused, thinking, oh, yeah, I've got that already. No, no. but, you know, that's that true religion, true monogamy, prayer, God consciousness, you know, that eighth one of these indispensables. Is that very remote endpoint? You know that as you're heading towards light and life, you know, everyone on the planet is striving for, you know, achieving such ends. The fact that prayer, I mean, just, you know, we'll eventually get to the paper on prayer where they have that indispensable, but eventually, the fact that they, you know, that one's in there, true religion, true monogamy, prayer, and God consciousness. Prayer is a very complicated one that serves a very important role in very early times, too. That's why we're literally programmed by the life carriers to pray. So, you know, you're starting as the most primitive human doing this. You know, it's not merely of advancing age, but they remind you that don't think that just because it starts out very primitive that it doesn't have the potential for a much higher mode. You know, literally to the point where it's indispensable to the advancing phenomenon of civilization. So again, kind of challenging you to not be too dismissive of prayer. You know, because sometimes we get in a mode where we talk about how, you know, prayer has its issues. And then human, you know, a lot of times the revelers say, yeah, humans, they've gotten way too fixated on prayer. You know, and should be more focused on worship. You know, they say things like that. But don't overplay that. It is one of the four indispensables to advancing civilization.
There's a lot of people that come into our country that need very help just by prayer. No. It's not, particularly if they come from far eastern countries.
There's so many things that kind of just happen inescapably when you challenge yourself to pray, that are those favorable conditions for growth. You know, the humility, for instance, that's kind of innately there.
Meditation and just wait a little bit longer, you get the benefit of worship.
Yeah, yeah.
You're just praying to continually go forward, and not take a moment.
Not pausing to, right, so anyway, not to flesh out all the indispensables right now, but I wanted to give you a little context there. That, you know, it's very important to stress the true religion, you know, and true monogamy. That's what makes what they're talking about of the advancing phase, right? The fact that religion and monogamy are in this holistic, philosophic, cosmic context that makes them true. All right, let's see. Anything else? Let's see. Notice again that they stress natural. Like I said, that's just a really key thing to start picking up on in the book in general. Let's see. I commented, let me just explain. When I said you kind of have the whole spectrum with delicacy of sentiment, refinement of moral character, and spiritual growth there, think about those three levels of meaning in the upper domain, fourth, fifth, and sixth levels of meaning. And the precision that you have because of the first cosmic intuition, so that delicacy is even possible. Right? I mean, until you're able to focus very precisely, all you can be is crude. It's impossible to be delicate if you can't bring things to a very, very sharp focus, right? The moral level, the spiritual level, right? The fifth and sixth level, see how they're fleshing out that fullness of human character there, in that triplet. All right, a little bit more here.
Pair marriage favors and fosters that intimate understanding and effective cooperation, which is best for parental happiness, child welfare, and social efficiency. Marriage, which began in crude coercion, is gradually evolving into a magnificent institution of self-culture, self-control, self-expression, and self-perpetuation.
Okay. I told you that in the last paragraph we'd come back around. And Riley said, monogamy is decidedly best for the children. And they haven't explained it yet. Well, here they're giving you a little bit of additional suggesting along about that issue. Paramarriage favors and fosters that intimate understanding and effective cooperation, which is best for parental happiness, child welfare, and social efficiency. So there's that child welfare. See, that's where it's coming back around. So you see what they're saying is the issue in play. Why it's, quote, decidedly best for the children. That intimate understanding and effective cooperation.
Yeah, which if you don't have it, your marriage doesn't last very long.
Right. And just think of what kind of, even an unspoken influence you're imposing upon your forming child. Right. If that environment isn't established. Right? Especially during those first 8 years, like they say, of that child's life, right? They pick up on those. You might even remember that you've got the classic line about what makes the biggest impression upon a child. That's up there in the religion papers. Children are permanently impressed only by the loyalties of their adult associates. Precept or even example are not lastingly influential. Right. So again, just that unspoken fact, that environment of loyalty that child is immersed in, one of the things they're pointing at. It's just huge to the development of that child. For their ability to sort of have the to have them initially directed in a way where they will discover the real God within them. For instance,
children will naturally try to play one parent off against the other. You know, if you don't have a solid relationship with your spouse, they'll do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if they
divide and conquer.
If they recognize that they can't divide you, then that gives them more security.
Mm-hmm.
It
mitigates against those ornery tendencies in a little child, right? You know, to be conniving, you know, and scheming, and kind of just forces them into to mature in an environment that eventually produces a child with character. Right? It just you don't have to. Again, you know, that, remember, you're just trying to supply favorable conditions. You're not trying to build a great child. You're trying to supply the favorable conditions so that great child is grown. Yeah. You know, that's what we're speaking to here. Not to mention, you know, besides the child welfare, you obviously have the parental happiness and the social efficiency of it all, too. You have the individuals that find it much easier to respond positively to the negative stimulus of the opposite sex and experience happiness. You notice they said happiness there. Because naturally, you know, we grate on each other, okay? It's unnatural for this to work, you know, for you to think positively, you know, especially because, you know, of the intimacy, like they'll point that out in the next section here, that intimate, inescapably intimate thing, you know, is problematic because of the differences between the two sexes. And then just, you know, they throw in that social efficiency. Right, that's reminding you of how this is the foundational element for the whole civilizational construct, and you know, if gears are stripping down in the foundation, you know, is the whole system going to work? So you know, in order for this to plug into the whole system and have it all work together. It has to be a well-oiled machine. Lots of different ways that this is important.
Well, especially when you first get married, it seems like a lot of selflessness is required.
Yes.
And self is kind of is in danger of being lost.
Yes, you know? Yes. Yep.
But here it affirms that, the self... There's all kinds of advantages for the self.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, that self-expression, see, you know, is there. I mean, because again, like, you know, if you actually start to achieve the real paramarriage thing, you know, that real part, the personal part, so that you genuinely get a super additive consequence, you discover that there is a potential for self-expression that wasn't available for, you can express yourself through that third fact that is a relationship in a way that you can't do in and of yourself. See, and it's not an issue of, you're not leveraging off of your spouse. See, when you literally have a real relationship, there's this third fact that allows you a mode of self-expression that isn't available to you any other way.
The we?
Yeah, well, or whatever you, however you want to think about it, there's a...
Yeah, it's
yeah, yeah. It's, you know, that's, you know, they're trying to remind you of that hydrogen and oxygen have all kinds of things under themselves available to them, but what they can do through the modality of water, see, is something that, you know,
where neither has gone before.
Yes, something totally unimaginable to either, you know, element unto itself. I never imagined that I could express, I could have that mode of self-expression. See, through that super additive consequence. Yeah. And see, and again, of course, that reminds you of why this is one of these indispensables to advancing civilization. And you can't get these very sophisticated civilizations that we can't even imagine right now without lots and lots of super additive, super summative stuff in play. See, that, right, you know, is what you can't imagine. You know, it's like, that's what they're saying. You can't imagine when you get better elements, you put them together, the kind of super summative things that result, that you've never even remotely experienced as you guys rattle around and bounce off each other right now. Yeah. Yeah. See, and it's all that super summative stuff that is that incredible civilization you can't imagine. You know, much more than the parts, you know, fancy as they are, living 500 years and all this sort of stuff, you know, and no disease and whatnot.
You see that in a lot of mixture of elements.
Yeah.
And in people, not just married people, but
yeah,
groups together, like what they talk about, you know.
Yeah, because
more of a square when you put people together.
Right, because you're of that relationship. Through that relationship, you express. You have this avenue for expression. You don't have any other way.
It's interesting that it's designed that way.
Yeah. Yep.
Paradise Trinity paper. What is it? Paper 10, maybe. It says the members of the Trinity, Father, Son, and Spirit, they share two things. They share reality of being.
Mm-hmm.
The second aspect is equality of self.
Mm-hmm. They're these three infinite selves, right?
Yes.
Yes. Right.
And nobody else, you know, compares with them.
And also, you know, you bring that up. Remember, they also point out, see, that's for each of them, the delightful aspect of the fact that the Paradise Trinity isn't just the association of three, but it's a fourth fact. It allows each of them a mode of expression that they don't have under themselves, or even just in mere association of the three. They can express through that fourth fact. And see, now that's the same thing I'm trying to bring out here, right? You know, hydrogen can express through water in a way that it can't express itself. You can express through that relationship in a way that you can't express, you know, under yourself. And it helps to just think of it as literally as you think, you know, that relationship is a literal third fact, just like the Paradise Trinity is a literal fourth fact, and not just the association of the three. So that you really seek to find that avenue of expression. I was just going to add to that the fact that it's super additive, right? That avenue of expression is higher than anything. See, it's not just different, but higher than anything you can express into yourself. You know, the two, the man and the woman, right? There's a super additive consequence. You know, they express through that in an upward fashion.
Yeah. And children, which is another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know if you call that upward, but maybe you do.
Well, yeah. I mean, you can bring in that, you know, that the degree to which children are a literalization of a super additive consequence as well. Right. The only complication is, they eventually get a personality, you know. See, whereas the Trinity doesn't, you know. Yeah. Yeah. So,
but then you're in a way, you're cooperating with the universe just to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So the obvious thing for them to talk about once they've sort of laid out true monogamy, you know, is divorce. Okay, so let's.
I thought you were going to say about the truth you were talking about. That's
kind of
interesting.
Yeah.
Recognize some of it.
Yeah, but they want to talk more about immediately about the challenge of this, we talk about this, the truth going through it and the super additive and all these, the ideal of it. And it's like, wow, it sounds like we're reaching. Yeah, we are reaching. So it's not going to just happen without, this early stage of development without lots of side effects. So let's get into those.
7. The dissolution of wedlock. In the early evolution of the marital mores, marriage was a loose union, which could be terminated at will, and the children always followed the mother. The mother-child bond is instinctive and has functioned regardless of the developmental stage of the mores.
Okay, so they're reminding you of, and we start with the horde phenomenon, like we talked about so much in the first paper. But here they're throwing in, I've brought this up here, they say it, see, just point blank. There's something in the mother that isn't in the father. Right? There's a maternal instinct. The mother-child bond is instinctive. The father-child bond is not instinctive. There is no paternal instinct. Right? Now, at a more rarefied level, right, there's a parental instinct. But don't confuse parental instinct with maternal or the notion of paternal instinct. The mother not only has maternal instinct, but in a subtler fashion, she has a parental instinct. We're mammals, right? And that maternal instinct is there, and the paternal instinct is not. Everyone knows that. It doesn't magically appear in us. That's just that's an instinct. That's a fancy animal thing. Okay, so they're just reminding you that the ancients knew that was the case, that the fathers didn't have a paternal instinct, so that's why children didn't go to the father. The marriage broke up. I mean, that's just obvious. Like they pointed out, I mean, it functioned regardless of the developmental stage of the mores, that maternal instinct, because it's pre-human. Not to mention subhuman, right? Animals have it. So obviously it's going to function regardless of these higher things of moray systems and stuff. All right.
Among primitive peoples, only about one half of the marriages proved satisfactory. The most frequent cause for separation was barrenness, which was always blamed on the wife, and childless wives were believed to become snakes in the spirit world. Under the more primitive mores, divorce was had at the option of the man alone, and these standards have persisted to the 20th century among some peoples.
Okay, so you have the basic, evolutionary things that they're pointing out, including the primitiveness of thought, the snakes in the spirit world. Like we pointed out, I mean, the whole point of marriage was to produce children, like we talked about so much. So obviously that's going to be the issue about barrenness is going to be the issue about, the main issue about separation. Notice how much problems you had with fertility. One half of the marriages proved unsatisfactory. Everyone knows how commonly couples have problems having kids even today. So that's an unfortunate part of the default, that we're still so kind of not together in that regard. They would have seen to our upliftment and getting those unfortunate strains, you know, bred out of the system and stuff, so that we would be much more, you know, much better expressed biologically than we are right now.
Yeah,
and the pain of childbirth and all these issues too, right, yes.
Kids wouldn't talk back when they were little.
Yeah, well, remember the more you advance the genetics, the more the kids are a handful, though, you know. You aren't passive, fancy animals. Mm-hmm. That sixth adjutant is problematic, okay. Okay, let's keep going here.
As the mores evolved, certain tribes developed two forms of marriage: the ordinary, which permitted divorce, and the priest marriage, which did not allow for separation. The inauguration of wife purchase and wife dowry, by introducing a property penalty for marriage failure, did much to lessen separation. And indeed, many, many modern unions are stabilized by this ancient property factor.
Okay, we already talked about, you know, that quite a bit, but there's, you know, I obviously want to remind you in this context how important that was to stabilizing things. It's like, oh, well, this is serious. Now there's money involved. And that's just the way we are.
Made it very clear that we got divorced. It would cost not only everything I had, everything we both have.
Yes, like they said, modern unions are stabilized by this ancient property factor still. Yes. And, you know, and here, of course, we see again this. So on the one hand, you can stabilize marriage by injecting it with all this false sacredness so that it's serious, to the couple, or at least, you know, like they're saying, to the man, you know, if it's really the man is in control of divorce. He doesn't want to be, cast out of the afterlife or something. So in that very early stage, you know, it's a positive thing to kind of give it this false sacredizing. But all good things taken to the extreme become bad, and you know, they're going to definitely remind us of that, that as you go beyond those very primitive stages where, you know, that's the only thing that's keeping it together, it starts to become a net negative thought to inject into the phenomenon. Okay?
The social pressure of community standing and property privileges has always been potent in the maintenance of the marriage taboos and mores. Down through the ages, marriage has made steady progress and stands on advanced ground in the modern world, notwithstanding that it is threateningly assailed by widespread dissatisfaction among those people where individual choice, a new liberty, figures most largely. While these upheavals of adjustment appear among the more progressive races as a result of suddenly accelerated social evolution, among the less advanced peoples, marriage continues to thrive and slowly improve under the guidance of the older mores.
Okay, so there's...
Last week.
Right, see, so here...
It sounds like it's just repeating itself.
Yeah, right, so we're bringing back that, you know, see, they're re-stressing that issue. You know, just like they did with the property, you know, issues, they're re-stressing.
Not just this, but others.
So, sometimes in the book, they will kind of bring some of the things together so that you don't have to, oh, this part is over here and this part is in this paper and this. They'll actually assemble a little bit because they want to have, in this section, they want to have a summarization of all the basic elements there, right there in that section, Because they want you to think more, not just about that part or that part, but they want you to lay all those parts out and think in a higher mode. That's the point of repeating. It's when they want, you know, they want you to see subtler elements that you can only recognize when you lay the coarse elements all out in front of you. I'll just give you a simple example. The Overcontrol of Evolution paper, right, gives you little summaries of all the basic biologic evolution things. It's like, well, didn't we already go through all this in detail in all those previous papers? Why are they repeating themselves? And again, they're trying to give you a summary so that you can see the biologic foundation and then think about what the paper's about, the mind, you know, aspect of evolution, right? It's above the biology. Right, so that's a common thing they do in the book.
Methods of teaching.
And let's see here.
But the Adamic way of teaching has never been surpassed, has never been approached, even in modern times.
Yeah, you know, so you teach in hierarchical fashion.
You
lay out elements, you put those elements together into a synthesis, and then you build upon that foundation. Let's see. Okay, so let's see. The thing at the end there, you know, reminding you about, you know, how we need to know when we're racing too quickly. You know, the more we can envision ideals, the more we have a tendency to try to race towards them, and not be patient and allow ourselves to grow slowly. You know, so you actually, it's like, oh, we should have really, really wonderful marriages. And what you end up with instead of more wonderful marriages is no marriages at all. They all fall, you know, fail. And those that are still having arranged marriages have successful marriages, and slowly but surely, like they're saying, those cultures are moving forward. And so you, again, it's that instinct that leads you to where Lucifer got. Ooh, let's just do it all right now by fiat. No, let's not. Mostly, let's be patient and allow this to grow. Let's not try to be the Apostle Paul. Let's try to be Jesus. Let's not try to have a dramatic conversion event. Why don't we have a nice, gentle, gradual, you know, developmental process?
Hopefully it's not nice.
And there is some ignorance to that. You know, I didn't use the word nice there. I mean, you know, you're not all thinking it in it and trying to build it and stuff. You know, it's just being grown in you, and you're not getting in the way. You know, because after all, genuine growth, you're unconscious of it. So there is an ignorance inherent in growth, right? Okay, let's see. What else we have there? So you've got these that are slowly improving under the guidance of the older mores. And then you have that, like I said, they were going to start talking about this more directly. Notwithstanding that it is threateningly assailed by widespread dissatisfaction among those peoples where individual choice, a new liberty, figures most largely. You know, the more you make this, something about ideals rather than about idealism rather than about pragmatism. You know, like we read, that historically marriage has basically been just, you know, a practical issue. But now we're injecting all these ideals in it. Well, if you have limited vision of ideals, that's probably not going to be problematic. But we're getting more and more spiritual all the time. And so our ideals are ever more transcendent. And there's no way that the marriage is going to live up to that vision. And it's not going to last. Again, there's ignorance of very transcendent ideals is bliss. Right? It would be better, like they're saying, if you didn't have words so far seeing, you know, in terms of ideals, if you were content to just kind of let it be mostly a pragmatic affair, and maybe there's a little bit of romance and you enjoy that, but it isn't all about some, how next week we're going to have an even more transcendent romantic experience than we had last week. And I mean, you're just going to run out of, you know, this happening, okay? And you're going to become disillusioned. So it's important to, you know, not let your idealism run. But, you know, they're pointing out that hasn't happened. Everyone is letting their idealism run, you know, totally without bridle. And so marriages are almost impossible now to be successful, because we want them to be more than they can be. We're a long ways from light and life. We need to, you know, be more relativistic, less, you know, about this. So that, you know, they're just pointing that out, that that's the fundamental reason why the Western world is experiencing so much divorce. You know, it's not because we don't have enough spiritual consciousness. That's because we have too much spiritual consciousness. It's like I've pointed out many times, you know, this book is in my lap, not because we don't have enough spiritual consciousness, it's because we have technically too much, right, for the amount of wisdom that we have. Right? Not in an absolutist sense do you have too much, but in relative terms, right? Yeah, you know, we're getting way out over our skis. Okay. Yeah. Exactly, because
really you've identified the mother, but I think for a lot of people, they're into this sun consciousness across the world. You know, maybe not Islam so much, or more of a spirit, but you know, Buddhism, you know, even Christianity, and the Father, what the Father is, it's worshipful problem solving. I've been read about, you know. The progressive element of society should be able to do that more regularly. You know, not just this thing where, you know, God's there when I'm born and God's there when I'm dead and maybe in Christmas. And well, it's an internal relationship to where the Father, you can read about it in Psalms. And it's just like, I don't want your burnt. It's almost like a relationship. She said, I want you.
Yes, exactly. You see, that's the point. When I said we have too much spiritual consciousness, it's like, well, wait a minute, Chris, I don't think that's valid. And how could you have too much enlightenment in the upper domain of your mind? But what you're saying, see, that's not what, you know, we know that's what we're not. We all turn ourselves inside out. We don't just make it an inner life affair, that spiritual consciousness. We want that spiritual consciousness to be observable in the arrangement of molecules around us, in the material external world. That's what you're doing. You know, marriage is a physical phenomenon. Okay? And if you as an individual have a spiritual predicate that will improve your outer life relationship that is that marriage, but don't turn yourself inside out, you know, and want it to be a spiritual affair in your outer life. That's material idealism, you know, that false idealism. That's the problem with, you know, the more spiritual we get, the more we have a tendency to turn ourselves inside out and not keep it as an inner life phenomenon. We wanted to rule the molecules in the external world, and that's when you have this, you know, it turns into a sacrament, and everything is falsely, you know, made, you know, sacred and everything. That's the issue.
You need to
see, just the more spiritualized your mind becomes, the more it has to be controlled, because the more it's going to want to flip itself inside out. I mean, part of that control is keeping the spiritual inside as a motive, as a beginning, not trying to make it what, the ending that's in the external world.
Okay.
Yeah. So, right. All those issues. Let's see. So where were we? Here. Did we get everything there? At the very beginning of that paragraph, besides the property issue stabilizing, they're reminding you of the social pressure of community standing. And we know that's another stabilizing influence. It's like, I can't get divorced because, my social class will, excommunicate me. All right.
The new and sudden substitution of the more ideal but extremely individualistic love motive in marriage for the older and long-established property motive has unavoidably caused the marriage institution to become temporarily unstable. Man's marriage motives have always far transcended actual marriage morals. And in the 19th and 20th centuries, the Occidental ideal of marriage has suddenly far outrun the self-centered and but partially controlled sex impulses of the races. The presence of large numbers of unmarried persons in any society indicates the temporary breakdown or the transition of the mores.
Okay, so just fleshing this out more. And again, like I was saying, I mean, if you, this whole bit of outrun, like I say, or overplayed, like I think I was saying, there has to be this appropriate balance between material pragmatism and spiritual idealism so that you get the proper cosmic consequence of the relationship between those two. And the marriage actually is genuinely of a higher quality. The quality of it is measured by its cosmic character, right? And not to mention, if it has cosmic character, it's upheld and is ongoing. You'll find that, this just seems to work. It's almost like this relationship is being upheld. It's taken on a naturalness that's kind of mysterious. Okay? See, that's because you have that balance. As they're pointing out, if you extremely minimize or even eliminate thinking about material pragmatism, don't expect it to be stable. It's not going to work. And see, it's basically because it loses its cosmic nature. Right? If you want to think about this in sort of higher physics terms. Let's see what else we have there. At the beginning there, notice how they're using the word motive. Individualistic love motive, the property motive, man's marriage motives have always far transcended. Remember, I've stressed a lot of times, the revelators want you to challenge yourself to use these words more precisely. You have a spiritual motive. And a mindal intention. Now, a mindal intention might have a predicate of a spiritual motive, right? When it's downstepped into the mind, that motive becomes an intention in the mind. But it's a spiritual motive. So when they use motive there, don't just think merely intention. But see, they're pointing out that that you're bringing in your personality. We've pointed out they've done this occasionally, reminding us how, you can be bringing your personality in. However, it might be in a not very cosmic mode, because you've drug something from the external world in and up and put it in that spiritualized mind space in the upper domain of your mind, you know, and it's and it becomes a motive, it can be a motive there, a spiritual motive there. So, see, that's, you know, that property motive, right, is an example of really bringing something that's material way up in there and spiritualizing it. But it has its place, as they're pointing out, not in eternity, but in an evolutionary process, it helps to stabilize. And that individualistic love motive, you know, again, we're talking about affection. Now, you're bringing that affection on the second level of meaning up into the upper domain, you know, and spiritualizing it and you know, basically ismizing it. So, you know, making it the everything of what this is about. And you know, as they're trying to point out, that's unrealistic, right? You'll exhaust yourself trying to constantly keep your feelings so amped up, right, that, you know, it just becomes the glue that holds everything together in this magnificent, transcendent way, right? It's just, you know, you're fighting a losing battle because those feelings aren't naturally resident in the upper domain, right? They're naturally resident in the lower domain, on the second level of meaning. And, you know, you're constantly having to push them up and they sift down through your fingers and are back down there again. And so, you know, you see people get in this mode of their relationship and they just become more and more desperate, trying to somehow keep these romanticized feelings, gluing it together, holding it together. You know, and you throw some kids in and all the, you know, dirty diapers and whatnot of that, and, you know, it doesn't hold together. Because there's nothing very romantic about a dirty diaper, you know, or having to take, a kid to their piano lessons or whatever. Okay. So, you know, they're just reminding you that that's fundamentally why marriages, we have so many divorces. Obviously, it's not the reason for all divorces, but it's why it's become so extensive. It's because we're overplaying the idealistic elements.
Okay. But it's okay to bring your wife flowers every now and then.
Yeah, see, again, it's not a dichotomy. Like I said, you need both so you can get that cosmic super additive consequence. Right, it's just, you know, you can't. I mean, when we're primitive, it can kind of be nothing but the material pragmatism, like they pointed out. But you can't get to advancing civilization without a spiritual element, right? So eventually, spiritual idealism has to come into play. But don't think, oh, well, now we can just throw out material pragmatism and just live pure. It's like, no, there are no stable creatures in the cosmos that only have six adjutants, for instance. See? All right. It becomes an innately unstable system once you have spirit in play, genuinely in play, you need that balancing element so that you can immediately get that super additive consequence and transcend the instability. Go up to stability, the stability of the cosmos. You can't do that on spirit alone. That's the key physics that's always in play in the fifth epical revelation.
You start separating the spirit from the matter.
Yeah,
mind instead of just putting it all together.
Yeah,
that makes sense. The worship impulse is what is still just one. It's one spirit, but then that, what is that seventh adjective?
Yeah, and you know, like I pointed out, I mean, one of the ways that you can very simply recognize that part four is not merely a description of the fourth epical revelation is how many times the midwayers When they're just talking themselves and not, rephrasing what Jesus said. But how many times they use the word cosmos or cosmic? See, I mean, Jesus as a spiritual uplifter, right, coming as the bestowed Son, is not going to talk about the cosmos. He's going to talk about spirit. The fifth epical revelation is going to talk about the cosmos and cosmic consciousness. And the midwayers, right? Part four is part of the fifth epical revelation. They're trying to get you to take the spiritual inspiration from the fourth epical revelation and bring it in parallel with all of the material pragmatic issues and get a cosmic recognition going. I mean, like, they introduced the levels of meaning there. You can't get meaning with mere value. You gotta have things. Things super additively plus values gives you meanings. And see, just the fact that there's those levels of meaning in there, see, is bringing a cosmic nature into it.
Yeah. Do you think Jesus was addressing just the sixth adjutant?
No, he's not. Jesus not. No, he's not. Definitely not just addressing the religious impulse. The sixth adjutant addresses itself in evolutionary religion.
Okay.
He's trying. He's trying to bring in genuine, spiritualized mind in the upper domain. He's trying to bring your personality and your encirclement in the Holy Spirit into play.
He's addressing people who have the seventh adjutant functioning.
First is talking about the Holy Spirit, laying that foundation before he's talking about the Spirit of Truth, for instance. Let's see. What else? Keep going here. Let's see. Make sure we got everything there. Yeah, I think we did. Let's keep going.
The real test of marriage all down through the ages has been that continuous intimacy, which is inescapable in all family life. Two pampered and spoiled youths, educated to expect every indulgence and full gratification of vanity and ego, can hardly hope to make a great success of marriage and home building, a lifelong partnership of self-effacement, compromise, devotion, and unselfish dedication to child culture.
So the one cool thing there is the end, kind of that expansion, expansion of marriage and home building. A lifelong partnership of self-effacement, compromise, devotion, and unselfish dedication to child culture. That doesn't sound like some magical, idealistic adventure, does it? No. So there's that. and then, like I said, I told you it was coming. The real test of marriage, all down through the ages, has been that continuous intimacy, which is inescapable, right, in all family night, right? That's what makes it so problematic, because there's so much natural tension between males and females. You force them to have to be that close together that much. Very difficult. There has to, see, you know, like we talked about before, there has to be, relief from that. We can't be hyper-idealistic about this. Men and women are very different. And we can do wonderful things together, but we both need, to be something besides just in that face-to-face intimate state. And we're just, it's too much. We can't handle it. All good things like intimacy taken to extreme become bad. That's what they're telling you there.
Manage that.
Yes, you do, right?
I mean,
I'm saying, you manage it in some way. You got to find a way to manage it, right? Hopefully in a more enlightened way than like the primitives did, where, they basically just never saw each other, right? Right, we obviously, we know that Adam and Eve weren't setting that example. Well, this is how we get along as Adam and Eve. We just never, you know, we're never in the same room together. You know, no, they weren't modeling that. They were working together all the time. I mean, how did they do it? How did they manage that so that, you know, the, you know, you didn't have this unfortunate grating on each other?
It's interesting. That's what, you know, these pairs, you know, were almost like twins or these ideal pairs in the Urantia book. And Adam and Eve were, you know, built together, I think, you know. But the first two that you have, that, you know, Adamson and Rada, they came from different sources, but they had enough commonality that they could do great things.
Now, obviously, that's one of the, you know, ways that you helped us. I mean, you can't imagine. It's like, well, I'm going to marry something that in every way, shape, and form is completely different than me. That might be too much of a challenge. You might want to find a couple things where you're kind of naturally on the same page, you know, like you're saying there. That helps a lot. There'll be plenty of challenge to bridge the difference. You don't have to force that upon yourself. Unnecessarily. Then, of course, they bring in that whole bit about how important it is to for parents to guide the development of children so that when they get married, they aren't too pampered and spoiled, used, educated, to expect every indulgence and full gratification of vanity and ego. Right. Yeah.
That was Jewish. It's obvious. Maybe a little too much.
Obviously a big problem, yeah. Okay, let's keep going here. Getting kind of late, so we need to keep chugging along here.
The high degree of imagination and fantastic romance entering into courtship is largely responsible for the increasing divorce tendencies among moderns, Occidental peoples, all of which is further complicated by woman's greater personal freedom and increased economic liberty. Easy divorce, when the result of lack of self-control or failure of normal personality adjustment, only leads directly back to those crude societal stages from which man has emerged so recently and as the result of so much personal anguish and racial suffering.
Yeah, don't forget, if we fall back to the horde to get to back, you know, go back forward again, that involves so much personal anguish and racial suffering. Like we talked about how many people had to die, how many horrendous lives had to be lived to get from tribe to nation. And then we want to just toss nation out. Oh, let's go back. No, you know, it's just the pain that you have to endure to go forward in the evolutionary process. Should sober us to not discard this stuff. But here again, see, they're stressing the high degree of imagination and fantastic romance entering into courtship is largely responsible for the increasing divorce tendencies among modern Occidental peoples. Again, like I said, it's this ungoverned, unwise, you know, it's fundamentally unwise, spiritualized minds is the issue. That's what's disruptive. Extremely prosaic is not a problem. It's not an emergency, right? Fancifully poetic is the beginning of problems. You need to be grounded. They're just stressing that again. Not to mention how much more complicated it is to have a stable system when you actually start to have some social equality, you know, between men and women. It's a more complicated system. Takes a lot more wisdom to make that work. You know, it's much simpler to pin it all down if one side of the equation is basically enslaved. Right?
You don't have to think.
But, right. Yeah. So, right, but it obviously is, yeah, lacking a lot of potential. Okay, yeah, let's keep going here.
But just so long as society fails to properly educate children and youths, so long as the social order fails to provide adequate premarital training, and so long as unwise and immature youthful idealism is to be the arbiter of the entrance upon marriage, just so long will divorce remain prevalent. And insofar as the social group falls short of providing marriage preparation for youth, to that extent must divorce function as the social safety valve, which prevents still worse situations during the ages of the rapid growth of the evolving mores.
So most of that seems pretty straightforward, but notice the key thing at the end. What's, you know, we have two things. We have marriage and divorce. Oh, they're a dichotomy. Let's, you know, falsely exalt one and falsely demonize the other. No, they're reminding you at the end. Don't think of it in dichotomy. Don't overplay the negativity of divorce. Right? To that extent, must divorce function as the social safety valve, which presents still worse situations. Right, if this is going down the tubes rapidly, you know, don't chain them to each other. That's
divorce part's really important. There's no education on it. Yeah. The only education people get is what goes on in their own family. And because divorce is so prevalent right now, that's what they're being educated at.
Yeah.
I mean, my kids don't have any, there's no classes in school at any level. Yeah. Teach anything about
Catholic Church when I was growing up.
This is always difficult. You know, it's kind of the, you know, if salt loses its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? You know, you always have this problem if you lose a long, like they're just saying, an evolutionary result that, you know, that came through a long hard series. You know, you don't just snap your fingers and reestablish it overnight. Because it's just, you know, like with universities, okay, if you don't have integrous professors, how are you going to have integrous students? You know, and that's the whole point of a university is to produce integrous students. You know, it's like, okay, the university's lost its savor. How, you know, wherewith shall it be salted?
Some of whom become professors.
Yeah, right. And then those, you know, ill-educated students become the professors of the next generation. It's just a very problematic situation when society loses these evolutionary results. It's one of the reasons why they've given us the book, so that you have it very authoritatively laid down, you know, and we don't have to grope through a million years to get it again. Okay, let's not belabor this. Let's see if we can finish up because it's getting really late here.
The ancients seem to have regarded marriage just about as seriously as some present day people do. And it does not appear that many of the hasty and unsuccessful marriages of modern times are much of an improvement over the ancient practices of qualifying young men and women for mating. The great inconsistency of modern society is to exalt love and to idealize marriage while disapproving of the fullest examination of both.
Yeah. That just, just close your eyes to the facts and, yeah. Yeah. Again, one must face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. And we lack wisdom. The wisdom to educate, you know, in so many ways. The wisdom to just get along with one another, you name it. In so many ways, we lack the wisdom to make this work when we bring in all of these more energetic energies, you know, when it isn't just, well, it's all just a property, you know, affair, right? You know, if it's gonna be more beautiful, like I think someone said, than that, right? It takes greater wisdom to manage it. So, just the one little thing. Notice there, the ancients seem to have regarded marriage just about as seriously as some present day people do, but did they really? Now, you know, you look on the surface, well, I mean, this is like nothing fancy. I mean, they have no notion of romance or anything. It's all just so mechanical and, you know, unenlightened. They don't regard this, you know, very seriously at all. And again, don't judge the book by its cover, like they've pointed out. There's a richness there that doesn't immediately meet the eye. And you can put a fancy whited coating on the relationship of today and think, oh, this is really fancy and cool. There's nothing inside, right? It might even be a whited sepulcher. So, you know, they're reminding you of that.
What did Anthony Bonson say? That their pledge was to live with and for each other, you know, basically the most primitive human beings.
Right, yeah.
But idealized. Yeah.
There has to be, you know, depth to it. And even though those ancients didn't seem to have depth, they did. That's what they're reminding you there by saying they seem to have. Yeah. Okay, so the final thing in this paper that we'll get to next time is they want to talk even more about this whole idealization of marriage. And how on the one hand, that's a wonderful step forward from primitive times, but it's so fraught with difficulties that we have to deal with.
These are pretty important papers.
Yeah.
They're the foundation of civilization.
Exactly. That's why, yeah, exactly. You know why I just said that we have to deal with it, we must. Why the revelators say must all the time. There's these very fine foundational elements. You can't just pretend that they aren't foundational elements. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.